Attention, citizens! It's time for Super Pulp Science!
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I am currently in a condominium in Ottawa, downtown on Bank Street, somewhere on Bank Street. There are all the details to let us know that a 47-year-old surfer
bro
lives in this apartment, and it's quite well appointed, but I'm here with my long-suffering co-host on this romantic evening in Ottawa, recently returned from Iceland.
I went to Iceland.
None other than Justin Curry, who brings up every 10 minutes that he was recently in Iceland.
As a joke.
What time was it in Iceland, Justin?
It is 2:21 in the morning in Iceland right
if
now.
If we were in Iceland, that's what time it would be in the morning. Justin, we are midway. We've never done this before. A mid-show recap.
It is Saturday night of a three-day convention. The Ottawa Comic Con started Tuesday at 2 o'clock. Friday at 2 o'clock. We've finished Friday. We finished Saturday. We're recording the podcast. We have not done Sunday yet. I've been doing this show since it began in 2014. Gregory, this is the very first time you've been at this convention.
The very first time I've done the Ottawa show. And the reason I did it is because the amazing organizers that do the Montreal, Quebec, and Winnipeg show also do the Ottawa show. And
very so well run.
I wanted to jump on the train. And also do more Canadian shows than U.S. shows this year. And so it's been great.
Okay, so for like people who listen to this podcast or people who kind of do stuff that we do, right? They make art, they make books, they create for a living, and they might be doing conventions or want to do conventions. How would you rank this show with other comparables in Canada?
You made the comparison that it's a lot like the Edmonton show.
I compare it to Edmonton.
So far, comparing it to Edmonton, I would say, as Claire C. Marshall would have pointed out on one of her excellent post-show blogs, this is a reading city.
They like their books.
Yeah, I've a lot of novels, like a lot of Automatic Age and Backbone of Night, which are like full-length stories, more words than pictures. A surprising number of those out the door, people really interested in trying new books by Canadian authors that they are not aware of. Comics doing fine also, but like that stands out my prose books outselling my comics.
Because they take up the least amount of your table as well. Like when you look at your table, you kind of have to look for the prose.
Yeah.
What about your weird, no English words, no sensible words?
Oh, the Thistle Grimoire. That one's doing pretty well too, yeah. Yeah, yeah. But I am looking forward to bringing that one to Old Quebec, where the Quebec show,
October 9th, 10th?
Something like that, 8th, coming up soon. At that show, I was completely surprised by how many of my products which are Lovecraft adjacent, like a little bit Eldritch horror, a little bit weird, a little bit esoteric, just were completely embraced in that city. So pretty happy to bring them to that. So this one a little bit less than that, but surprised in other ways.
And yeah, we've talked about it on the podcast before, but I had this conversation a couple times today about people asking, are you going to have this print by the end of the day? Are you going to have this print by the end of the weekend? Do you have lots of this? Do you have lots of that? To which I reply, it's been doing this full time since 2014. I've been doing conventions since 2008. And every convention is different. Every year is different. It's frustrating trying to pack your inventory for every convention because you have no idea what everybody is going to be kind of after that year, whatever, like every city is different and every year is different. You don't know how much you need to bring of everything and it's always changing. So we just kind of do our best and usually make a couple, usually make a couple mistakes along the way. This show, trying to think if there was anything that really stood out. My original Dozy Diners, especially selling quickly in Ottawa. And by comparison, I did Toronto just like a couple weeks ago, biggest show in Canada. I probably sold like 5 of each of those prints. And this show, I've sold 20 of each of those prints. They're all gone. And this is a much smaller show.
And content-wise, those are these delightful landscape formatted illustrations of giant robots that have been either reclaimed by nature or reclaimed by city developers after some cataclysm or war and been turned into restaurants and coffee shops and... It's
dormant war mechs that are powering restaurants and coffee shops and ice cream shops and...
And there's so many little details in them, but also your display, by virtue of the longer table setups that we got a wider format, you are displaying that wide format stuff.
They're front a little, and yeah, center. They are more on display.
Yeah, yeah. They're definitely the focus of that layout. So here's the other thing that I noticed in this show. I put out a little on display of everything in the catalog because I've never been here before.
So, yeah, you don't know what the crowd is kind of after. Once you kind of have an idea, this is a show that enjoys video game stuff. This is a show that enjoys books. This is a show that enjoys the more like abstract. You kind of you gear it that way. That's but you right. kind of just everything.
I put out everything. And then after the first like 3 hours... I had a gauge of kind of what people are interested in, and then I reorganized the front-facing display to depict
every
what
day, do you
people
like,
were responding to.
Every day do you reorganize your display a little
bit? A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. It's funny how suddenly like a print that wasn't moving before catches on because you move it to a certain point.
Yeah, but also it's like, you know... Tara, my wife, she makes fun of me when I'm cooking because, you know, if you're just supposed to, like, leave it on the heat for, like, 7 minutes, I have to poke it.
Yeah.
I have to, like, flip it over. Like, so I'm like that with my table, too. So I can't just leave it be. I have to make adjustments.
I know. This is where you tell me all about how locals rule and yuppie insects like me shouldn't be surfing your break and all that, right?
Nope. That would be a waste of time.
One really interesting event occurred at this show. An archivist, someone from the Archives of Canada, who, you know, for those of you who don't know how it works, when you publish a book in Canada, there is a Canadian archive that you're supposed to send a copy to that book.
You're not supposed to. You are legally bound.
Yeah. You're legally required to send it to, but what they do with it is they archive it in a facility that's intended to keep it for hundreds of years safe. Like, that's how it's designed, and that's how it's
archived. Preserving our history.
Yeah, preserving Canada's history. And one of those archivists came to the table and said, I saw Midnight City 1, 2, and 3 pass my desk, and I read them on my lunch hour. And, like, didn't put them in the archive right away.
They're not going to last 100 years.
That's right. They've been read them, really liked them, and then came to get more stuff. And then remembered that Justin hadn't sent his in to the archive on time because she, keeps track of the graphic novels that come and go because she's really interested
she's
in them.
She's a fan. Yeah, she's...
So it was really funny to have met this person that is... you know, essentially a gatekeeper of...
To have a government official come and I'm a fan, you haven't submitted your books yet.
Yeah. It's a really, like, gratifying experience to know that someone who, like, is supposed to keep it safe gave a shit. So you for sure it got put on the right shelf.
And, like, told us, this is in here, that's in there. I remember that one's in there. Like, a Canadian government official was reassuring us that we liked your books and they're in this archive. And
so much of that mechanism feels so faceless.
Right.
When you're involved in publishing. So, like, an actual person to show up and be, like, a big nerd was the greatest feeling. And then came back again today and was like following up with some conversations and just talking about, it was really cool. I asked a funny question, like under what eventuality are you preparing the books? Like, what is the staff room conversation? Like, we are archiving this in case of a blank volcano, nuclear war, right, alien invasion. Like, what are they being? And she made a joke to say, like, we don't talk about that. We're not supposed to talk about
don't
it.
Don't talk about the event.
Yeah. And then we got interrupted, so I couldn't follow up and find out if she was joking or if that was like a literal part of the workplace environment that they just don't talk about what they're saving them right from. Right. So that was an interesting twist. Another thing about this show that I find strange is that the convention center is only 4 minutes, 5 minutes taxi ride from the airport.
If that. It's within eyeshot of the airport, but a 15-minute car ride to the city itself.
Yeah, 15, 20 minutes. And if you're, yeah, like, anywhere outside of the downtown core, it's, like, 45 minutes probably to get there.
Yeah.
So everyone is driving a long way to be at the show, and they stay the whole day. Like, from 9 a.m. until, you know, 7, some people are there right, the entire day.
There's not many people just there to look. Yeah. Everybody's there. They put in their time. They paid their monies. They're going to get something out of it. So yeah, it's a bit of a different behavior of attendees than, you know, some of the shows we do.
Yeah, and there's programming after, too. So you'd think that, yeah, a show that's long, that's far away would close and let everyone sort of go home. But then, you know, people seem to line up and be keen to, like, stay for, like, nerd-themed game shows and stuff after. It's interesting to see how that all forms together.
Yeah. No, it's a bit of a different show. I feel like finally this year, Greg and I are staying at an Airbnb in like downtown Ottawa, which is really beautiful. Lots of awesome restaurants and like a very active street. I feel like I've actually seen Ottawa this year because usually I stay at the one hotel by the airport right beside the convention center, which is convenient, but you really don't get to experience the city at all. And yeah, it makes a big difference actually being able to go into the city itself and experience some of it and not just work the convention and then stay at the hotel in the middle of a field by the airport. So,
and if you're asking yourself, why stay in a hotel or why stay at a B&B and not a hotel? Because of delightful things like this. If you open 3 drawers in a row and you found cowboy hats, power tools, and what was that?
And photo books.
And photo books and Nerf guns.
Yeah. Goggles, too.
And goggles, yeah. And then you try to create a picture in your mind of the person that lives here. It's very difficult.
It sounds like the intro to a murder mystery podcast.
If this is our last recording, I want you to know that the High Tide Killer did it.
The High Tide Killer. So one thing came up during this show that I kind of wanted to talk about. There is, across the aisle from both, like myself and Gregory, we have 3 Artist Alley tables. We have like a fairly large presence that goes up 12 feet in the air, takes over 18 feet across, and is like the accumulation of
a decade of effort.
More than a decade of building up. So we've talked about it on the podcast before. We've built the ziggurat, right? We have a large display. And across from us are some people who are just starting out or just kind of like getting into this field.
Building their momentum.
Yeah, you know, like they, you know, they have a couple prints. They have a couple products. Who knows how, you know, they probably have actual jobs or they're going to school or whatever. And I was just kind of feeling like a bit thankful that I started when I did, because when I started doing conventions, there was nobody like us doing it because everybody was starting out at the same time. Nobody had this figured out. Nobody had huge displays. So I didn't have to compete with anybody who was 10 years ahead of me. Because there wasn't 10 years of conventions yet. Everybody was on year 1 or 2, and it was easy to catch up. But now people who are starting out have to be across from people like us who have stolen so many tricks from so many different people and brought them into their skill set and built up this big thing.
And why this is important, dear listener, is because we're only really separated by about 15 feet, maybe 20.
Yeah.
25 at the outside, maybe. And so you can really look into their eyes. You can see when they are disappointed if traffic begins down the aisle and then swerves away to the bigger display. And it's making both Justin and I feel a little bit guilty. Not because we, you know, we're there to do what we're supposed to do, but when we're across from each other at a show, it's no big deal. Because, like, it's clearly the displays are of equal sort of size and measure, and so it's people's interest in the content that is steering them. So you're not really worried if someone went to that one or that one, it's what they're into. But if you're very small, it can be easy to be overshadowed by essentially the big magician's trick that's going on in the other side. And then it feels like you're taking away from someone that is just trying to build up momentum and you don't mean to. If I'm competing against someone else who's been in it for a while and they're on a corner booth, you don't feel I don't feel any empathy towards the, we're all in the same game. Right. But when you're scooping from some student who's probably taking time off work to do the show, I feel bad about it.
But yeah, it felt like when we were starting out in the early days of 2008, 2009, conventions were a new thing. We were all taking time away from our jobs to try out this hobby thing that was Comic-Cons and making art and selling prints. And then it became something that could be a full-time job, and we have poured our time and efforts into it. So when somebody new comes along, it just feels like the mileage is just much more drastically stretched than it was when we started. And
so, dear listener, the corollary here, the thing you can take away, is that the person who makes the show floor map is also a human being. And in this case, we know them pretty well.
Yeah.
If they had received, or if they were in the future to receive emails that said, I'm only a single table, I'm just starting out, can you please place me with other people that are similar to me? They'll know.
Patience, Hotshot. Patience. We'll be subtle if it's here at all. There'll be a group within the group. These guys are a real tight unit. You'll see them. You'll know it.
We've talked to some people before who think that if they're too close to a big deal, like if they're right beside the Cyanide and Happiness booth, or like the, you know, the
Todd guys, McFarlane.
Yeah, Todd McFarlane. That people
or the
will
chasing
make,
artworks.
Yeah. But people will make, once they've made a big purchase from like a big booth, they will kind of get out of that area. They felt like they've spent money in that area and they want to...
You're talking about the superstition of the skip over effect.
Yeah. I just bought something from this booth. I'm not going to look too carefully at the booth right beside it.
Yeah.
I want to get some movement in before I make another purchase.
And there's this like, there is like a body language when you're disengaging from a booth with a goodbye and a whatever.
You started going and you don't want to immediately stop again.
Yeah. I don't really believe in the skip over myth. I think it's a myth because I table next to you and I do fine. So they're not skipping.
I feel like my thing is if I see somebody holding a bag with your art in it, I know I can get them. And the same with Quirkylicious. If somebody's holding Quirkylicious's work, I know I can get them as well. It's like, if they're into
your
stuff.
Dear listener, if you've been got by Justin, he means this in the nicest possible way, I think.
I'm on their spectrum of interest as well, kind of thing, you know?
Right.
And I think you get that the same way. Like, if they're holding my stuff, you've got a fairly good chance of getting them as well.
Well, it's like certain people who have become our peers and friends, they have their work comes from a certain set of influences and tastes,
right,
which we either admire or agree with.
Yeah.
And so you have that instantly in common with the person.
Yeah.
So it's not that he wants to get you.
You know what I mean. Like,
but you
it's
can
like, oh, these are my people.
That's right.
They've bought the ticket that says they are my people by buying art from Drake or you
or Ronnie. Yeah. If you see people who are carrying stuff from people we know, our peers, our friends, you know, you have that in common with them. And so, like you say, they feel like our people.
Yeah.
And you can bring up too, like, oh, I love Corkylicious. Oh, I know Chasing Artwork. Yeah, oh, yeah. Scott Ford is a great artist, right?
Yeah, I saw a lot of Scott Ford stuff today. And I always relished in covering his stuff up in the bag when they bought stuff from me.
Oh, yeah. Dear listener, Justin does this horrible thing. You should know about it. Never. I've never, ever admitted to doing it.
People love when I'm just going to cover up Gregory's stuff. Oh, you know, so it's fine. We share a studio.
Because we are very conscious about the environment, we don't want to use too much plastic bags. If someone already has a plastic bag, we will offer either a new bag, or if they'd like, we will put it in the current bag, and vice versa. If they don't have a bag, we'll give them one. Justin's favorite trick is to make sure that whatever he's purchased covers up whatever
I sold. Come on, tell me, when you're using their bag, you don't put your art facing outwards instead of whatever they bought last? It may be true
that if your work is there, I've taken both prints out, turned them around so only the white part shows on the outside. It may be true. But only if I ask them to walk past your booth and try to get you to see it. So yeah, that might be true. Where are we going with this, aside from that we're jerks to each other? Oh, the skip over effect is a myth, I think, but I can understand why it feels that way to some people.
Yeah. Well, there's certain people, if you're listening to this and you're across from me, you got to stop looking like somebody pooped in your coffee, because I think that's part of the reason people don't want to stop and look at your stuff is like, yeah, if...
The reason people are flocking to Justin's artwork is because he's put in literally a decade of hard work, both in the front lines and in the digital realm of building up awareness. And so you're competing against a number of fronts.
We both put in a lot of hours into our artwork, but I've been at this show for 6, 7, 8 years, and this is your first time here.
That's right. And our calculation is that 80% of our money comes from 20% of our repeat customers. I don't have any repeat customers at this show.
Right.
Yeah. This is all first time.
You have to work a lot harder than I do, because I had to work hard initially. Yeah. But now people have gone through this song and dance with my booth over and over and over again. Sometimes it almost feels like I don't even know if they really want the new stuff, but now it's tradition. They've bought stuff from me every year since 2014.
They probably don't want it. You can kick the habit. If you check out Kick the Habit, chasingartwork.com, you too can kick the habit through my 3-step hypnotism course.
Quit smoking and quit chasing artwork. With Gregory Kimmich.
Quit chasing artwork. Actually, quitchasingartwork.com is a great URL if someone wants to buy
it. It's kind of good,
yeah. And then it'll be a competing account.
Quit chasing artwork. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, and it's just pictures of your shatter vector with like lines through it. Yeah. Quit chasing artwork. I like it. Come with me, people, on this new journey. I've begun.
All right, what else we got?
Well, I will say that this is a show, and I won't get too far into it or too heavy about it, but this is a show that is one of those things where my chosen profession, my chosen passion, my chosen career path is also happening at the same time as a whole bunch of pretty tragic and horrible personal events are also occurring at the same time. And I have family in Ottawa, and so I'm managing all of that stuff parenthetically around the show. And so maybe this is a good way to say, I've been really practicing my compartmentalization over the course of this. It's like, unpack the emotions of this thing I have to do outside the show, and pack them all up into a tiny box and put them on a shelf in my heart and just try to be a good ambassador for the Ottawa show. So my fear is that because I'm essentially holding back a bunch of complicated emotions at any given moment during the show, I'm worried that I seem insincere when I'm trying to be excited about some things, because I do have to force it a little bit at the show, because there's a lot going on outside of the show thing. And so that's my next year. I'll find out whether people come back. That 80-20 rule, right? It'll really be next year where I find out whether they felt like I phoned it in or whether I really made the connection I'm trying to make.
I don't know. I think you're not what you never, even when you're down, you can't turn off the, not the ever jolly, but like you're never sullen enough to turn people off in the con situation. I don't think you have to worry about
that. I hope so. I like people, and so I try to be present for each interaction with that person. I try to reflect what I'm receiving. I try hard to do that.
All I'm asking for is 90 seconds of your life, Johnny. That's it.
I do notice in, like, just it's, what is it, like 10-hour days we're doing?
Yeah.
I will happily explain certain things in the first 2 hours, first 3 hours. By hour 6, 7, 8, 9, I know I have a pre-recorded speech about this, that, and the other, and they just stop coming.
Okay, so that's a good thing to talk about. In, like, a magician calls it patter.
Right.
Which is like the stuff you talk about before the trick. Like, for example, you know, if you're about to do a quote unquote mind reading trick, obviously it's all been prepared.
Right.
You've planned it from the beginning. The envelope is taped under the guy's seat.
Right.
But you go on this long story about how you were in the Himalayan mountains and you met a guru and then you learned how to read minds.
Is your grandfather's name Mark?
That's right. Yeah. It's all patter.
How did you know?
And you try to make the patter seem sincere.
Yeah.
But the problem with a trick is that if the patter doesn't seem sincere, the trick also is not surprising.
Yeah.
How do you keep it from seeming like patter when you're repeating what is the same question that a person might ask, or the same, you know, how long does this take? Where do you get your inspiration?
Because it's like a weird sensation. It's almost like your brain turns off and just something, like you, the recorders hit play. And the words are coming out of your mouth, but you don't have to think about them anymore because you've said them so many times. How long does a piece take you?
Yeah.
I don't have to consciously think about it. It's like a subconscious part of my brain.
Just gives that is reciting a version of the answer you've given 1,000 times.
Yeah.
But how do you, or do you just not, you don't try to keep it interesting or fresh?
I say the same thing pretty much every time. If it's early in the morning, though, then yes, I will actually think about it. I will give a bit of a different answer. There'll be a bit more pitter-patter. But after 100 interactions with 100 different groups of humans,
it's tricky.
Yeah, circuits are a bit frayed, you know?
Yeah, and I think but maybe
Their circuits are also a bit frayed. They've also had 100 different transactions.
Micro-transactions in their minds with strangers
they've
that they'll never see again.
They've waited in line. They've talked to people in line. They've gone to different booths. They've gone to different vendors. They've gone to panels. They've, like, downloaded all this information.
I'm just now realizing that maybe one of the reasons why I rearrange the front-facing prints, like this, what do we call, like, the display prints, like the ones that you have out, is that so many people are responding to the print, and that is the basis of the conversation. I'm wondering if unconsciously the one of the reasons I swap it is to protect myself from having the same conversation over and over.
You don't want to keep...
Yeah. If I change the Dracula for the Carmilla, for the Frankenstein, for the War of the Worlds, then I'm having 4 different conversations every 15 minutes instead of the same one about it. I wonder.
Do you sometimes... If there's a really popular print and you're getting low on it, you'll kind of hide it away. You'll take it off the front of the display and put it a bit over here or in the book just so it'll last a bit longer.
There's no.
No? No? Okay.
But I do have one in this show in particular. Oh, man, this sounds like... I don't mean to gripe, but it's like... every single person who sees it and understands it, gets the joke of it, says the joke out loud.
So you don't have that print out front
anymore. It is out front, but it's, and it gets a lot of attention, and I really, you know, I'm proud of it. Like, as a piece, I'm very proud of it. I think it does a good job, but because it does its work, I used to define art to my students as art is the ability to put an idea in someone's mind without their permission. Right? And I don't mean in like subliminal advertising. I mean like to force them to confront an idea. Like good art forces people to confront an idea that they didn't know they were going to have until they looked at it. And so in a way, every time a person repeats that idea, I know it's working. It's a culmination of the effort of design. But I'm not surprised by it anymore. So it's like, yeah, I get it. Yeah, right. I know. Yeah, of course that's, you know. And I'm trying to be genuine about it, but that's when I feel false, is when they're like, oh my gosh, and they're just having that reaction for the very first time, but didn't realize it's the thousandth time I've seen it in the last 30 hours.
You're the comedian telling that joke for the 100th time, so you don't crack a smile or laugh, but everybody
finds maybe it that's
hilarious,
it.
Right? Like, you have no reaction because it is not new to you.
Yeah, it's funny. I'd never thought about that, but like a comedian, you know, you watch the special once, maybe twice, and you laugh along with everybody else, but they've done that special 1,000 times
and they,
on the road.
They need to have that, like, not reaction, right? Yeah. If they laughed along with it, it wouldn't...
Ruins it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how you know Pete Holmes is practicing new material, because he laughs.
God, yeah. I love Pete Holmes, but his podcast is hard to listen to because he laughs... Because
he's coming up with new material, and he's laughing at it. Yeah.
Yeah, like, he sounds like a very fun guy to hang out with. But yeah, he laughs at everything, so his podcast is not as funny as his actual stand-up and skits. But.
I had an animation student asked me about my favorite part of the creative process, like what part do I like doing the most, which was a kind of a fresh take on the, like, where do you get your ideas? Not like, where do you get your ideas or what inspires you, but like when you're working, what's the part of work you like the most? So I found that to be interesting.
Oh, that's a different question.
And I realized today that lately my favorite part of the work is getting it wrong. Is the work that leads up to the finished product. Like, once I've tried a composition 5 or 10 times and I zero in on what I think is going to work, then once I know what that idea is, like if I've drawn it in my sketchbook 10 or 15 times trying to get it, now I'm just carrying out the plan. Right. That's not as exciting to me as all the times I thought it was close. Like, oh, I think I've got it. And then I try. No, it doesn't work. Oh, I think I got it. No, it doesn't work. Colors.
Do you mean like in your head, you think you've got, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
But then when you actually do the art, you find the better solution. I was wrong, my thought of what it was supposed to be. And through the trial and error, you actually hit a way better solution.
That's right. That's my favorite part right now. It's like that idea that they say sometimes about design. First idea, worst idea.
Right.
Right? So you have an idea and you're like, I have a great idea.
Yeah.
And so then you write it down and then you come back to it and you try to refine it. Because the thumbnail, the little sketch of the idea maybe doesn't take into account the rule of thirds, doesn't take into account color theory, doesn't take into account where the focus of the eye will be on multiple points. You thought it was a good idea, but when you're actually breaking it down to what will work as a single panel of illustration for a print, it doesn't work. But then you don't want to give up the idea, so then you refine it.
You're in love with that idea.
Right, you're in love with the idea, and so then you iterate and you try again, and the failing, the work in a math class, you know, the teacher always says, show your work.
Right.
The final answer is not the interesting part. That's why they mark you on the work.
God damn it, who's in charge of this camera crew? It's a crime scene area, for Christ's sake.
Earlier when you said, like, art is putting an idea in somebody's head, what I usually think art is that translation to the picture in your head to what physically comes out. And how great it is, the more hours you put in, the closer that
you can get to
that journey gets, right? What you think about can be what you produce.
I would fairly honestly say that I rarely does the thing that that's in my head come out exactly as it's in my head.
And so to that, sometimes it does. Sometimes I have an idea for a piece and it turns out like one-to-one exactly what I thought of. I did a Horizon Zero Dawn piece recently, and the idea I had for it was exactly what I produced. But some of the better pieces are when I have like a half-baked idea of what I want to do, and the real magic happens in the production of it. Mm-hmm. Like, it gets itself figured out as it's being made.
I like to
what you're talking about.
Yeah, we use different kinds of techniques, but I like to break down the negative space, if I can get, and depending on the kind, but for my horror series, if I can break down so that more than 60% of the print is actually black, like just black ink, and the total composition, depth, and color theory still work, that is my absolute...
That's your goal.
I love that. That's when I'm feeling like, okay, I've got it. And they always start as much more complicated illustrations. Mm. And it's like, oh, what can I cover up? What can I cover in shadow? What can I cover in shadow? Oh, it still looks like the thing it's supposed to be. Oh, still. Yeah. Oh, now I have to make that negative space. Oh, now I have to add that highlight. That part where I'm trying to cover up everything that's complicated until it's as simple as possible and still the idea.
Reduce.
Yeah.
Gestalt. Reduce. What is Gestalt's main principle? If you don't need it, get rid of it. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's to
remove.
Yeah. It's the idea under. It's in a way, it's like existence precedes essence, right? The idea is already solid. It's already formed.
Yeah.
And now you have to get at the essence of the thing.
You got to chip away the granite until you get the statue underneath.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Speaking of chip away. Now, okay. Let's switch gears here for a minute.
Okay.
How many boats is too many boats for a room?
So that's... I'm the wrong person to ask because I fucking... I heckin' love boats.
You like boats. So there's a number of boat things. How nautical themed is too nautical a theme for a room?
So we've got a little Popeye sailor head.
There's a
boat.
There's a sailing ship.
Right.
There's a stained glass that seems to be of a shoreline. There is... There's a few other things that I thought.
He's a surfer, so I mean...
There's a painting of a gnome with the biggest doobie you ever saw on the wall here. So that's not very sailor-themed, but I suppose that gnome is about to sail away somewhere.
He's about to sail away somewhere.
Right? The bed flips up like a sailor's bed.
Yeah.
Into the wall.
There is a rack on the ceiling for a surfboard.
To hold a surfboard. There's a license plate that says Aloha on the wall.
Yeah.
I find this place peculiar. When I looked it up, I have to say, dear listener, what really got me was the table we're sitting at right now, which is this carved out of like raw wood with a copper plate.
13.
Yeah, handmade table. Yeah. Really liked that. Thought, I'll write my next chapter of the book on that table. This is what I'm going to book out.
We're not usually staying at B&Bs that people live in. We're staying at like empty shells of homes.
Yeah, it's a good point.
This usually is not empty shell of a home. This is a home.
Yeah, we're usually in a cast-off hermit crab's shell. And in this case, the hermit crab just left for a minute to go to Nova Scotia to do some surfing.
We're in a different shell for a second.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah.
Anyway, have we given too much personal information about this person?
No. He can deal with it.
His SIN number is, according to the mail, no.
He left cute little post-it notes all over his kitchen, like, hey, don't use this cup, it's my favorite. And like, don't use these bowls, they're really special.
Yeah, and take your shoes off over here, because I just refinished the floor.
We didn't take our shoes off.
I did.
You didn't.
Podcast.
They're over by the couch. They are not outside the condo as requested. They are by his couch.
I have complied to everything I said I would in this B&B. We watered the plants, though.
I did water the plants.
Yeah. Ottawa is the first show in a little while, and it's the beginning of a pretty busy convention stretch, right?
For you.
For me, because I'm doing this show. And then I would have been doing Edmonton next weekend, but I don't think I am. And then the weekend after that, I have something local. Prairie a library Comics. Event. No, I have a library event.
Oh, and then it's Prairie Comics.
Prairie Comics. And then Quebec City.
That's like two. That's in That'll, October.
Yeah, at the beginning of October.
Yeah.
And then
Winnipeg.
And then one other show. There's something else.
There's something in November?
I think so. Yeah.
Is there something about them? No. You got the flea, the punk.
Punk rock flea market? No, that's rock. Before. Anyway, the point of all this is it gets really busy and it's easy to lose track of those details.
Yeah.
How do you organize those details during a busy convention season so that you don't do something silly like not book a flight or not book a B&B?
So I have a Dropbox folder with a convention cheat sheets folder in it, and in there is Ottawa 2023. And within that folder is a folder of hotel, a folder of printing, a folder of tables, a folder of flight, and I fill up those folders with screenshots of here's me booking my flight. Here's me booking my hotel.
All the receipts. Here's the receipt numbers.
Yeah, here's the receipts. Here's the confirmation. So, for example, in Toronto, if I got to the Toronto Fan Expo and they're like, we don't have your table invoice, I can go into that folder and, like, here's me paying for my table months ago. Here's the confirmation. Then when I go to check in the hotel, we don't have your confirmation. I have screenshots of me buying it here and here and here. And so I just have this big Dropbox folder full of shows. And then I also have a physical calendar just kind of marked down. Here's when you're gone for Ottawa. Here's when you need to ship things for New York. Here's when you need to print things for San Diego. Here's like, so just like.
So that would have a double duty at tax time also, where if you've forgotten or you're double checking what you've claimed or paid for or what you're.
Yeah.
Costs are, you have another place where you definitely kept the receipts.
Yeah, I also like when, because we're businesses that we get to write off business expenses. Usually when I'm on a convention trip, I try to pay for everything with my credit card just so there is
a nice clean
solid transfer.
Yeah. And when you travel, dear listener, if you're just new to this, you can claim 100%.
Yes.
Outside of your home city.
Right.
Of.
That's why we eat at the fanciest place.
Yeah, you can.
The Cineholic Gregory. Where'd you have dessert from tonight?
Oh my God, I'm so ashamed. I don't want to tell anyone. I wanted a piece of pie, dear listener.
I've never seen dessert served in a. It's like a Big Mac box from McDonald's.
It's like the way a Cinnabon makes you feel so ashamed, the Cineholic makes you feel even worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's basically a Cinnabon with also pie topping on top.
With whipped cream and...
I'm so sorry, future Gregory, that you ate that. I'm so sorry. But it was an impulse purchase.
Jesus.
Oh my goodness. Also, there are no good horror movies playing in Ottawa at this time.
Right, yeah. We did try to see a scary movie tonight at a local theater. There's nothing good out except for the Taylor Swift concert experience, which the thumbnail was the Winnie the Pooh horror movie.
Yeah, some joker at the Cineplex put in the Winnie the Pooh movie but titled it the Taylor Swift concert experience.
Like the monster movie of Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
The Blood copyright and Honey. Lapsed, so...
It's in the public domain now. It's not copyright. It has lapsed. Right. The copyright, sort of, your copyright is forever, but whether or not it's in the public domain is what matters. And Winnie the Pooh is now in the public domain, and someone made a horror movie called Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey.
I heard it was
Honey.
Really, really terrible. They made it for zero money, put zero effort into it. It's not worth watching, even as a
having been on movie. The set of independent films, even ones with no money, they didn't put... I haven't seen it, but I can tell you they didn't put zero effort in. It's a lot of work to make a movie, even a bad movie.
I mean...
Even a bad movie is hundreds and hundreds of hours of work. So, they made a bad movie.
I haven't seen it. I've heard, even for people who really like bad movies,
it's
that try, this was a bad movie that didn't try, apparently.
This is like the direct-to-VHS of direct-to-VHSs?
Something like that, yeah.
For the dear listener who is born of a certain age, a VHS is a cassette you used to put into a VCR, and it would play a movie on a magnetic ribbon. I know, it sounds crazy, but this is how we used to live.
50-year storm. What's that?
That's kind of a legend.
No, it's real. It's absolutely real.
When you are at shows and somebody comes up to you and is very rude or very rude to a customer, is there a tiny spiteful maneuver that you have come to rely on to make the whole thing feel better?
Yeah.
This was a leading question.
Yeah.
Dear listener.
There was a situation today where I've got a good amount of table space at this show. I have three tables, which means I have like a good length of space that my stuff is stretched across. And as a result, quite a few people can kind of look at my, I have portfolios and I have thumbnail sheets and I have like menus out. So like people can kind of check everything out at once. And at some points when the show was really busy, there's a lot of people on the floor, you feel a bit like a bartender, right? Like,
yeah.
It's up to you to kind of like eye everybody up and like, okay, they were here and then they got here and they're here. And you kind of are keeping an eye on everybody like, okay, these guys are ready to go. And then those guys have like made their decision as well. You can kind of tell when somebody's still making up their mind and need more time
need
to
a little
kind
bit of
figure
time.
Out.
Yeah, that's totally
right?
True. Yeah.
You
yeah.
kind of get that
and
sense.
You communicate to them, I'll be with you in a second. I'm going to just deal with them. Or someone is going to be quick and someone's yeah. going to be long. So you say, I want to give you a little more time. I'm just going
to
deal with
these
guys.
And yeah, so I try to prioritize. I want to acknowledge everybody. Hey, right. I'll be with you. Hey, how's it going? And then kind of turn away. Like, so people know that you've noticed them.
Right.
And that they're like on your radar. And then also, yeah, if people are like, oh, I'm going to get this one and this one. And we're still thinking, then I'll go, okay, I'm going to help this guy over here, and then I'll come back to you. And, you know, that's a good trick as well. Like, they know that they've got half their order together, and you're going to come back to it.
Yeah, it's like diffusing the
finish.
Diffusing the bomb of people being disappointed in you.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they cared enough to stop and pay attention to your artwork,
yeah.
and now you don't want them to be disappointed in the version of you that they see. So you try to manage it.
But every so often, there's that
every
guy...
So often. It's always a guy.
He's always a guy. And I feel like he spends a lot of time at clubs. So he knows how to get a drink quicker than the rest of the people, you know. So he kind of like elbows his way in and goes, hey.
Like snaps his fingers sometimes.
Yeah.
I'll
get one of these. And there's nothing sweeter than telling him it's sold out and turning away immediately.
Whether it is or not.
I don't think I was actually sold out of that piece. I'm pretty sure I had one hidden away, but like...
You weren't going that extra mile for the jerk.
It was like 6 hours in, and there was a lot of polite people waiting their turn.
That's right.
And I don't need that guy's business.
Yeah. So just be nice to people, dear listener.
Do you have you experienced that situation like that? Do you have a story that goes along?
So I really like... I don't do it if the show is like... super busy, I can't afford the time to do it. But one thing I love to do, if it's the right pace of a show, on the back of each of the prints, I'll do a little doodle as a tangible thank you.
Which I got to see firsthand. People would like get your doodle and then come over and like revel in it in front of my table. Like, oh, I got this like little tripod. Oh, I got this like lady
right,
with the hair.
Yeah.
And they're like, look what I got. Like they love it. It's such a great little personal touch.
And I love it because I try to respond to their energy and I do a little sketch and it's really fun, right?
Yeah.
It's me and them and that moment and I'm making a little piece of art and it's just for them. And we have a little, if you have enough time, when I have enough time to do that, it's amazing. But sometimes if the show ebbs and flows, I just can't offer it.
Right.
If there's just too many people asking for stuff and wanting stuff, you're trying to manage people's disappointments and their wait times, and it's a busy show, and sometimes they have kids, and you're diffusing the bomb of their expectations.
They feel the pressure of the crowd as well. Like there's a lot of people trying to check things out.
Yeah.
They want to kind of finish the transaction and move on as well.
Yeah, and not something, you know, it's a strange problem to have. So... then I don't make it a guarantee. There's no big sign that says it comes with those things. I'd do it if I can and if I can't. So every now and then, someone who got the good experience of getting one
comes back at a super busy time.
And they demand it.
Ooh.
And not in a like pleasant way, like, wouldn't it be nice or could you? But like, aren't you going to draw me something?
Whoa.
Right?
whoa.
And I'm like, well, you know, normally I do, but it's like really busy. And, you know, I'm sorry that I don't have to. Well, then, right? As if that was.
And like sometimes that shows we have helpers, right? And so that mitigates that, yeah, that pressure. So yeah, your help, like the person that's with you can help out the crowd while you do a quick sketch for somebody else.
Yeah.
But it, a lot of shows were solo and it's a juggling act and you can't.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, yeah. And I wonder, you know, in a tiny way, this is what we see a lot of A, B, and C list celebrities at these shows at their signing lines. And they have different ways of dealing with individuals. And sometimes they have very strict guidelines as to what kind of interactions they have. And I wonder if that is a result of those, like once they had no boundaries and people yeah, took advantage and now they have to have for strict sure, boundaries. Yeah. Right? So maybe it's a little taste of that.
Like that's this, like you can only get two things signed.
Yeah,
you only because get, some guy brought up 300 things to get signed, but exactly, he was immediately going to sell on eBay, yeah, and there was nothing saying he couldn't do that. Yeah. So
exactly, yeah. Flippers. I hear that a lot from comics writers who are signing books. That flippers will come. They've bought, you know, a hot issue. They brought 50 copies of it and they've brought it to be signed for free. And so a lot of people mitigate that by saying any signature made out to an individual, like this is like for Tom.
Right. Yeah.
Is free.
Yeah.
And if it's just signed with no dedication, then they charge for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I have few things signed, but every once in a while they like they'll need the name to yeah, go on it. And it's because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So stop the flippers. You flippers have ruined it for all of us. I recently found out that I don't think you can get, speaking of flipping, the Apocrypha graphic novel through regular channels anymore. I don't Ooh, think it's listed. And I noticed that many of the online booksellers have it for 2, 3, or 5 times its cover price. So if you're one of the people who bought an Apocrypha book off me and you're looking to make some quick money, then maybe that's the way that you can help yourself. I'm going to try and get some more copies at a reasonable price so you can skip the flippers. But we'll see what happens with that. I don't like speculation in the comic book game, but it is... You know, it's pretty normal.
It's a part of it.
Yeah, it's just a part of it. Have you ever seen your work flipped online for a higher price?
Yeah. I do limited edition foils. And after, like, some of the New York and San Diego Comic Cons, if you go on eBay, you'll see some signed limited edition chasing right, artwork prints for more money than, yeah,
than is reasonable to you.
I mean, yeah. Yeah.
But well,
that's kind of cool.
It is kind of cool. It's nice to be wanted.
I've also had my stuff stolen and posted on Facebook Marketplace by thieves.
But then... The police tracked those people down.
There was a sting operation.
Yeah. Oh, my God. What if that thief is listening right now and now knows?
Well, he's a fan, clearly. He framed my art. I have it.
You received it back as evidence from the police?
He got a bunch of my stolen artwork. He frames some of it. The police broke, like, went to his place and took all my art back, including the art he framed and gave it to me. So now I have framed artwork by a thief.
If only he'd signed it, then you
see
could flip it.
Episode 79.
That is made up number, but we definitely did an episode all about it.
We don't remember our podcast anymore, so yeah.
Well, dear listener, we are coming up on the end of anything reasonable, rational, or interesting that we have to say. However,
bedtime.
We made a long list of side adventures, side quests, and misadventures, which maybe we'll record for the next episode.
I still have to do my postmortem on Fan Expo. I guess I kind of did my Iceland trip. I went to Iceland. But when we're all back in the studio, yeah, we've got lots to talk about.
Dear listener, do you have a friend who's gone on a trip somewhere and they come back and they bring up that trip every few hours?
I made that joke.
I have that friend. I have that friend. I used to have someone who had just recently come back from France, telling me about France all the time and croissants. Now I have someone talking to me about Iceland all the time. And both of them work in my frickin' studio. So, this has been Super Pulp Science, where we talk about Iceland and how comics get made. This is GMB Kamishuk encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.